You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
From the heart of where innovation, money, and power collide, in Silicon Valley and beyond, this is Bloomberg Technology with Emily Chang.
Taylor Riggs in New York in for Emily Chang. This is Bloomberg Technology. Coming up in the next hour, getting a better deal. Elon Musk now saying that he might try to renegotiate the sale price for Twitter, causing the stock to fall even further as many questions remain over how viable this takeover actually is. Plus, billions wiped out in Terra USD in that crash. What can we learn from it? What does it mean for the future of stablecoins? We'll discuss all of this and more with John Wu from Ava Labs. And while Dr. Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, it topped box office records here for the second straight week. Are movie theaters back? Are there still headwinds ahead? More on that later this hour. But of course, we cannot go on for at least 2 minutes into the show without talking about the latest drama between Elon Musk and, of course, his takeover and the proposed takeover of Twitter. Really interesting comments coming out of Elon Musk today, hinting that he might want to renegotiate the deal at a lower price, saying that it, quote, wouldn't be out of the question. And these latest comments, of course, coming from Elon Musk via a video conference at a summit over down in Miami. And it was hosted by a podcast called All In. For more on these comments, of course, where the deal stands, I'm so pleased to be joined here by our very own Mandeep Singh, of course, over from Bloomberg Intelligence, and Kurt Wagner joining us from Bloomberg News. Kurt, can I just start with you, from someone who's been following and covering this company and, of course, Elon Musk himself? How do you think just sort of the way that this has played out and the drama that it's putting really on the company too?
I mean, doesn't this just feel like the most Twitter thing of all time to happen, right? It's just this deal that just continues to be a roller coaster. And the fact that we now have Elon kind of coming out today and suggesting, hey, I might be, you know, interested in negotiating a lower price for this deal, even though I just offered something else a few weeks ago. It just all feels like this is kind of cascading in a negative way for Twitter. I always have said that the worst case scenario for them would be that this deal falls apart and they're kind of left standing there without anybody to come acquire them. And it feels like that's becoming more and more likely every day.
And Mandeep, let me bring you in on that, because similar to what we just heard from Kurt, I was hearing from Dan Ives over at Wedbush earlier saying, again, sort of this worst case scenario, they're going to be left at the altar alone, right? How do you think about the lack of no bidders? And is this Elon's way of negotiating down in price?
I do think, you know, he doesn't have a way out of paying that $1 billion in breakup termination fee in case he wants to walk away. But at the same time, the odds of the deal happening are higher than they were probably 3 weeks back when the deal was announced. And the reason I say that is because at least he has $6.5 billion in commitments from, you know, co-partners. And what he really wants to do here is to, you know, move away from that margin loan. So right now he doesn't have about, you know, $12 to $13 billion in financing. He has already sold a bunch of stocks. So that's about, you know, $11 billion. He's got $6.5 billion in commitment. So he really wants to move away from that $12.5 billion margin loan. And that is what I think he's looking to renegotiate here to bring that price lower.
Very interesting. And Kurt, I think at the heart of this issue comes down to the percent of users that are represented by bots. When you think about Twitter, whether that number is 5 or 20% relative to Meta, Snap, TikTok, I mean, sort of the other social media covers companies that you cover, how does that bot relationship fit into this narrative?
Yeah, he talked a lot about that today. He was at a conference in Miami. Our Bloomberg reporters, my colleagues, were not at the conference, but were able to listen into the conference as it was happening. And he brought this up. You know, he was saying, hey, this is an issue. I don't believe that the bots are less than 5% of the total user base, which is what Twitter says in earnings. And there are, and Facebook says something similar. To be clear, this is not a unique situation for Twitter. But Elon has had an issue with bots. He's made it part of his kind of campaign of how he's going to clean up the service and what he's going to do to change Twitter. And he's saying he believes it's to be a lot higher. And we saw CEO Parag Agrawal from Twitter kind of going back and forth with Elon today, trying to explain, hey, here's how we measure bots. And Elon replied with a poop emoji, right? He clearly was not interested in Agrawal's explanation here. And I think that's a big sign as to why he's, you know, saying this is on hold. He wants more answers.
You're not allowed to use that emoji with me, Kurt. Neither is Mandy.
I would never do that.
Mandy, you've been commenting on this similarly. You take a look at a bottom-up analysis of these companies, the actual fundamentals, user growth, revenue growth, profitability. How, Mandy, do you think about the percentage of bots and the impact on the health of this company?
Well, so clearly it's a bigger problem with Twitter. And when you take out, let's say, 5% of the users are bots, so the EV per user goes up that Elon is paying with this deal. And when you look at a comp like Snapchat or Pinterest, right now the EV per user is close to $100, whereas with the $44 billion deal, it comes down to around $200 for Twitter. And look, Twitter had this problem of, you know, basically exaggerating their user numbers, and they had to kind of come out and say that the actual user numbers are lower. So it's not a new problem, but clearly if you're valuing a company based on the total number of users, then you have to think about, you know, revising the price lower because the actual number of users are lower.
Mandy, just a follow to you on this. I think we're having a broader discussion, and this broader discussion is underway about if that price target set a floor for how we think about valuing these companies. And the broader market is telling you, at least today in the last few weeks, we're rethinking valuations on every level, not just because yields are higher and the discount rate falls, but the big valuations of growth at any cost. How then sort of is this played out in the also thinking about the way that we're valuing these companies and these tech companies?
Well, so clearly, you know, social media companies aren't really growth companies anymore. If you have to think about, you know, growth, really, it has to, the next leg of social media would be more on the metaverse side. Right now, valuations have gone down everywhere. But I think Twitter isn't a high growth company anymore. Yes, it can sustain its EBITDA, but we're not talking about 40, 50% growth, even if it goes private. So that is where, you know, you have to really think about which is actual growth going forward as opposed to what can generate free cash flow to pay off the you know, interest payment.
And Kurt, come back in here. I think as we think about pushing this story forward, what do you want to see next? What are you looking for? If what can we do private that we couldn't do public? What do you want to see in terms of leadership? What are you really looking for to understand if this company really can turn it around?
Well, I think the best way to grow the business is not going to be to abandon advertising altogether, which is what it feels like Elon kind of wants to do. He's talked about a subscription product. I think that's fine. But really, I think what you need to do if you're Twitter is you need to figure out how to get the kind of user data that works with targeted ads, that works with direct response ads, right? That is what Facebook and Google do really well. It's something that Twitter has always struggled with. They already have an ad business. They have advertisers who are interested. They just need more granular data in order to do that direct response type stuff. Now, it's easier said than done, but I think that's the one thing that if they can figure that out, I think the business could really benefit from that.
Mandy, do you agree?
Well, clearly, I think subscriptions is part of the story here, but we've seen subscription businesses aren't easy. Look at Netflix. You know, Netflix is moving into ads, so you really need a combination of ads and subscriptions. Moving away completely from ads would be a mistake.
Really appreciate it, both of you. Great insight. fundamental analysis. So appreciate the conversation. Mandeep Singh, of course, and our very own Kurt Wagner out there in our beautiful San Francisco office. We want to talk now about a new social media law out of Texas that has many in the tech world fearful of what might be allowed to flow on your feed, all in the name of censorship. Groups representing Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube warned the Supreme Court that unless this Texas law is blocked, anything from Russia propaganda, as well as neo-Nazi posts denying the Holocaust, could show up. Insiders, of course, now warning that these extremist views could cause social media companies to lose millions in advertising. For more, I'm joined by Techonomy founder David Kirkpatrick, who thankfully you've been sort of all over this. And I am curious, we think about, I believe, a Supreme Court who can decide what cases they want to hear and what cases they want to rule on. What at the heart of this issue really is going on for some of these tech companies?
Well, thanks, Taylor. Basically, what the tech industry is asking the Supreme Court to rule that a federal appeals court's ruling last week, which allowed this law to take effect, must be removed and vacated because the impact that it would have on tech companies is so extreme that it would almost make it impossible to operate any kind of website where there is conversation if that site has more than 50 million users. It's a truly inane, idiotic, and illogical and crazy effort to change the rules for what seems to be just partisan advantage.
Talk to us about the advertising, of course, that we mentioned in the introduction. The companies, of course, benefit from the advertising. What would stop sort of that flow of advertising, in your opinion?
Well, that's a great question, because obviously advertisers only want to appear in an environment that's rational and makes their products look good in contexts. If websites are prevented from taking down any kind of extreme statement by any user, it could really make these sites much less kind of comfortable for advertising, and I could see it having an effect. Although the problem is even more basic than that. Mm-hmm. Essentially, the companies are being told by this Texas law, if it were to really take effect, that they can't make any real decision about what kind of content flows across their own networks. But these are commercial companies who built these commercial websites for commercial reasons. They have every right under the Constitution to operate their sites as they see fit. And this law attempts to remove that right from them, which is just plain wrong and unconstitutional, clearly.
Let's talk about something else I'm reading here in your notes. It really speaks out to me that it allows people to also sue these companies as well if they're censored for their viewpoints. How does this sort of open up, and I know that we're not lawyers here, but sort of open up the floodgates for these potential lawsuits as well, and then the impact that has on businesses and consumers?
Well, there's so many crazy aspects to this law, but one way to think about it is that the companies wouldn't be able to do well no matter what they did. They would be damned if they do and damned if they don't, because the law allows anyone whose viewpoint, which is the term they use, has been used as a basis for removing their content, to sue the company. Okay. However, if those viewpoints are hateful, racist, show some kind of libel or whatever, they will then probably, but they're prohibited from taking them down, remember. People who are affected by those posts will almost certainly then sue the sites because they are being affected by these posts that have not been removed. So in effect, the sites can't win either way. It just underscores yet again how fundamentally illogical the law is. But it's worth remembering, it seems like the whole point of these laws, and there was an attempt at a similar law in Florida, is to get back at the websites, particularly Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, etc., because they're perceived to have an anti-conservative bias. And the conservative majority in the Texas legislature has passed this law, and the conservative Texas governor has signed it. But the fact is, it simply cannot work. And it's being done for pure political partisanship and without enough thought.
David, it's interesting. You mentioned Meta, of course, formerly we knew that as Facebook. You mentioned YouTube. We're talking a lot about Twitter, of course, right now in the zeitgeist with Elon Musk, of course, stepping in and giving a price potentially to take private. Of all the companies you've been studying for decades over the years, who would be most impacted and who is most susceptible to getting a hit, of course, from this?
Well, the law is meant to apply to any company that has 50 million or more users, but it really is intended, it's aimed at Facebook and Twitter primarily, and YouTube, because those are the sites where speech, so to speak, is most frequently taking place, and they do frequently make judgments when hate speech or political incitement or violence is endorsed or whatever, to remove posts. Mm. Now, it could affect any site that has over 50 million users, which could be, for example, Netflix or Disney Plus. If there's any kind of content or conversation, well, I guess those are probably not good examples, but any site that has any kind of dialogue, say the New York Times or any kind of Bloomberg for that matter, if the number of users is big enough, there will be no allowance for moderation in effect. So it's taking away a fundamental right for any company that is attempting to foster a safe and rational conversation online.
David, what do you think as you think about sort of the next step, pushing the story forward? Do you want to see changes to the fundamental businesses so that this isn't an issue? We talked a lot about Twitter having its crisis that it's going through right now. What are you really looking for as you look to these companies?
Well, there are really big questions. And the reason this situation has arisen does flow in part from the failure of management by these companies. I don't think that Facebook in particular, or any of the social media companies for the most part, although to some extent I'd leave Snap and maybe even TikTok out of this, but certainly Facebook and Twitter have not done as good a job as they should have of articulating what is allowed and what is not allowed and sticking to very clear standards from the beginning. They let themselves get into a place where there's a sense of chaos. And I think part of it was they were trying to placate the Trump administration and didn't want to seem to be anti-conservative. And they really allowed a lot, I think they allowed a lot of inappropriate content that was supposedly conservative, but was really inciting. But now, because they took down enough of it that it got the right angry, there are legislators all over the country trying to take these rash moves against them, really out of partisan dislike. But I think the long-term issue is the companies have to establish clear standards for what is and is not allowed and communicate it clearly and stick to it. It's very, very hard. I don't think most of these companies anticipated when they got into these businesses how complicated the decisions they'd have to make would become.
Yeah.
But that's where they are, and that's just the fact.
A complicated issue. We're grateful that you're here to give us your expert analysis and insights. Techonomy founder David Kirkpatrick. Really appreciate it. And we're going to have more to come, of course, including a report on the impact of, well, the China lockdowns, what that means for us. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
China's economy is paying the price for the government's COVID zero policy, with industrial output and consumer spending sliding to the worst level since the pandemic began. Our very own Bloomberg's Stephen Engel has more.
Clear sign China's economy contracted sharply in April as continued COVID zero lockdowns hammered industrial and consumer activity nationwide. With its two wealthiest cities, though, Shanghai and Beijing, under COVID restrictions, retail sales nationwide plummeted a worse than expected 11.1% last month as tens of millions of people were confined to their homes. Factory output, too, tanked, falling 2.9%, the largest and only second year-over-year monthly contraction of industrial production in 32 years. Yes, since 1990. Now, the consensus estimate was for a modest rise, but clearly China's industrial might was slowed by the lockdowns and those supply chain issues. China's nationwide jobless rate also ticking up to 6.1%. Now, Shanghai has been in lockdown for nearly 2 months, but this week is starting to relax some of the most strict curbs as COVID caseloads and inter-community infections start to fall. Now, Beijing has signaled policymakers will step up support for the economy, as evidenced by the PBOC on Sunday cutting mortgage rates for first-time homebuyers. China's National Bureau of Statistics also admitting that COVID outbreaks in April had a big impact on the economy, but claims that the negative effect will be short-term and that economic activity should start recovering gradually. Still, the economic shocks from Xi Jinping's zero-tolerance approach to virus containment are obvious, pushing China's ambitious full-year growth target of around 5.5% further out of reach. Stephen Engel, Bloomberg News, Hong Kong.
Our very own Bloomberg, Stephen Engel. Now, of course, talking about those supply chains, the head of the Port of Los Angeles's cargo flows from China to the busiest port in the U.S. appear consistent despite that ongoing pandemic. Here's some of what Gene Soroka told Bloomberg.
This is going to take some time. There's an episode just about every day that impacts us in the supply chain, whether it's on the ground, the atrocities in Ukraine impacting energy and agriculture goods flow, the lockdowns in Shanghai, 8.3% inflation, producer prices going up 11%. All of this is in the supply chain equation.
Soroka says that there are no imminent signs, of course, of a slowdown in demand from American consumers based on the number of full shipping containers that they are seeing arrive in the port. Coming up, we're still on that theme. Inflation, of course, still on the rise. Interest rates climbing. Tech stocks falling. What's next on the horizon? We have all of that more. And next, this is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Technology. I'm Taylor Riggs in New York, in for Emily Chang. Let's get an update now on the markets. The sell-off, Katie, of course, still joining us now. Katie Greifeld, it just continues. I mean, we're looking at tech and the NASDAQ 100 off an additional 1% today. Hard to catch a break.
Absolutely. Friday's bounce, it came and it went very quickly. Of the S&P 500 ending 0.4% lower, big tech felt even bigger. You had the NASDAQ 100 finishing about 1.2% lower. And that was even as some of the steam came out of Treasury yields, the 10-year Treasury yield falling about 4 basis points or so on the day. And you have Bitcoin, it's rallying a little bit after hours, a little bit of a nudge, but yesterday, or this current day, Monday, it fell over 3%. You can see it's below that $30,000 per coin mark. And what caught my eye is that you actually saw the CBOE volatility index, the VIX, it actually fell a little bit today. Mm-hmm. It's back below 30. That's still above its one-year year average, about 21, but still a little bit of a breather today, even as you did see that sell-off resume. But the question becomes, I mean, how much can volatility really fall as stocks continue to fall? If you look year to date, you can see the NASDAQ 100 down about 25%. So big tech, those growth names really taking the brunt of this selling. The S&P 500, it continues to flirt with that bear market. Again, that is at 20%. It's getting closer, Taylor, at about 16% year-to-date losses.
And of course, Katie, we're so excited to have you tomorrow joining us on Bloomberg Markets.
I can't wait. From
2 to 5 p.m. It is our pleasure. So really appreciate it. Katie Greifeld, of course, joining us here with more on these markets. And that sort of leads us right into our next conversation. We've talked a lot about this sell-off. What does it mean for a new round of fundraising, right? When you think about all the belt tightening around the corner, does that cascade into another big problem? Does it mean a slowdown in enterprise technology spending? Does this drive down another leg in the industry's earnings outlook? Well, if you have earnings, that's the first problem with some of these companies. B Capital co-founder and managing partner Raj Ganguly, of course, joining us here for more. Can we just start big picture? When you think about just the pressure broad-based on these valuations, maybe it's risk of recession, maybe it's rising yields. How are you thinking about portfolios of some of these new companies? And, well, the pressure now, they may not be worth what we thought they were.
I think that it's the exact right question that everyone's asking in VC is, what are your companies truly worth? You may have paid something for them 6 or 12 months ago, but I think where the market is going is actually very healthy. We're resetting to a set of valuations that are going to make more sense and actually help us build better companies. And while there's going to be some short-term pain, I think that eventually you're going to see some of the sectors that are traditionally resilient, like healthcare, cybersecurity, bounce back first. But we're going to have to go through a bit of pain, and a path to profitability is going to be one of the most important discussions that everyone is having.
Talk to me about that. So I remember, I think I was in San Francisco in 2019, and we were talking a lot about WeWork at the time, and it was about growth at any cost no longer works. Growth at any cost has to be reevaluated because we need to see some free cash flow soon, and we need to see it sooner rather than later. Is that the same conversation we continue to have now?
You're exactly right. I mean, growth at any cost has never worked. I don't think we are dramatically shifting to survival at any cost. You still want growth, but you want growth at a much more reasonable cost. And what that means is looking at things like the burn rate of a business are going to be really important. I mean, that's things that if you're not a profitable business, you've got to be managing your burn during times like this. And frankly, if you're a late stage business that was hoping to IPO, you better have at least 18 months of runway because the IPO markets could take a while to come back.
I've been reading a lot of just sort of the market analysis about how to prepare for a recession. If it's conserving capital, even if a recession isn't coming, how do you plan for it? How do you think about that capital, the balance sheet, the employees, the culture, and making sure that the people around you are appropriate? What should some of these big founders be thinking about when they're trying to manage a business through this volatility?
You know, I think these big founders got to where they are because they're great leaders. And I think over the next 6, 12, 18 months, you're going to see, you know, who amongst this group really knows how to manage. And managing morale is going to be difficult when some of morale was built around, if you're a public company, it was built around stocks and stock options. And if you're a private company, it was still built around your shares and the valuation in the private market. And now you're going to have to motivate employees who primarily were being paid through stock, private or public, and motivate them to work harder than potentially they've even ever, you know, worked before in a much more challenging environment. I think the great leaders are the ones who are going to do it by telling people that stay focused on our purpose and our mission, and we'll all make it through this together, and we'll come out the other side a better company.
We've long often talked about the, if you want to use the word bubble, and we don't have to use that word, but a lot of that sort of inflation of the valuations came from too much capital chasing too much cash, right? Chasing too few companies. How do you think about the deployment of that cash and the best use of cash then at this moment?
Well, since you already went there and you used the word, what I would say is that
I'll take the heat.
What I would say is that You know, cash now is going to be for very core activities. You've seen businesses that have gone into a lot of non-core activities. I think you're going to see a retrenchment to the core. You're going to see companies focus on the regions that really make sense and already are profitable or have a shorter path to profitability. And you're going to see more add-on businesses that can be launched for much lower cost versus things that are far from the core. You know, specifically for us in software, healthcare, and fintech, the three areas that we invest, we think healthcare is probably one of the most resilient sectors. We're going to continue to invest there. And frankly, for some of our businesses that have a lot of capital, this is the time to play offense and look at how you can acquire companies for lower valuations. Mm-hmm. And I think you'll see corporates do that too over the next 12 months.
Really appreciate your time, your perspective, your knowledge and insights. B Capital co-founder and managing partner, Raj Ganguly, thank you as always. Of course, we want to go back to maybe private companies, back to some of the big public companies that we've been following. Microsoft is set to boost employees' paychecks in an effort to combat inflation. The company announced its plans to nearly double its budget for employee salaries and boost the range of stock compensation it gives to some workers by at least 25%. This is all in an effort to retain staff. The move said is to mainly affect early to mid-career employees, all at the software giant. And of course, coming up, what is the future of stablecoins after the Terra Luna debacle last week? We'll discuss. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for the Future Investor Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Our crypto report. We have to get back to that meltdown that followed the Terra USD algorithmic stablecoins collapse. In total, investors may have lost as much as $42 billion in that crash. This is according to Elliptic. Our crypto contributor, Sonali Basak, is here with more. And I think my favorite line from Katie Greifeld on Twitter was UST no longer means US Treasuries. How the heck is this all about crypto?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, especially because there's a lot of stablecoins to keep an eye on, USDC, a Tether, and UST is the one we're certainly talking about now because that's the one where the depegging has really led to a lot of losses among Terra ecosystem investors, and you have Terra now talking about restructuring the plan here so that people can recoup some of their funds potentially or at least start to build on the network in a broader way. But if you look since the initial depegging, 92% almost, 91% of a decline and ripple effects indeed across the DeFi ecosystem. But let's just take a look at Bitcoin itself for a second, Taylor, because Bitcoin is, of course, the largest of cryptocurrencies. We've seen it bounce back quite a bit since the initial fears about the crypto ecosystem at large, and now only down about 16% over the 9-day period. We have 7 days of gains. We have about 3% worth of losses over a 24-hour period, but again, just coming off that low again, but still just hovering around 30,000.
It's been such a wild swing. Sonali, you've been all over it, so I want you to stick with me here. I want to bring in John Wu, of course, into this conversation, president of Ava Labs, of course, lead developer of the Avalanche blockchain. And Just big picture to kick us off, I think some of the biggest questions is, if it's a stable coin and it's not stable, what is it? How do you think about that?
Well, first of all, there's a couple of types of stable coins. There's ones that are actually backed by US dollar reserves like USDC. And then these algorithmic stable coins like the Terra Luna, which was, you know, an innovative experiment. Unfortunately, we can all say it didn't work out. But in the back of all of our minds, I think every crypto native Web3 person really has a hope that someone could figure out a monetary system or a stablecoin that doesn't rely on existing things that, you know, are traditionally out there as reserves. So we all rooted for it. Unfortunately, it did not work out. It's still very early in the space, and I'm sure there will be more experiments and innovation. Now, in terms of the latest restructuring plan, from what I understand, they are trying to figure out who are the smaller holders and use whatever's left in reserves to basically give back to those smaller holders. So that would be my number one thing at this point. It is what it is, but use whatever reserves to give back to the retail people that were left holding the bag, if you will. And that's the best thing to do at this point.
I want to ask you more about that, John, because what does it say about the restructuring of a crypto ecosystem? Who should get paid? Who has claim on the assets at the end of the day? And what does the protocol actually owe to its investors? How does this play out?
Sure. That needs more clarity over time. But to me, at least from a common sense perspective, this is the one industry where the retail investor have actually call it front-run institutions. For years, it's been retail investors globally that supported this ecosystem till very recently in 2020, 2019, if you will. So philosophically, I think, again, the right move is to use whatever is left to figure out who are the small bag holders or wallet holders and try to make them whole as much as possible.
So what about the idea that other stable coins can be made with new models? You talked about experimentation here for a second. To what extent does the industry need something like an algorithmic stable coin or a partial algorithmic stable coin in order to scale, John?
So the industry right now does not need it. What's going to come out of this situation is USDC, which has a lot of transparency, backed one-to-one with the US dollar, will gain market share. USDT was tested a little bit, but they need to come out with better transparency, and they will do that. And then you had other stable coins, you know, FRAX, CELO, they've all held up, actually. So it would be nice to have an algorithmic stable coin, but just like any economy needs a certain unit of account for a medium of exchange that is stable and not as volatile. And for now, maybe one that's tethered to the US dollar and has transparency is the best thing.
You know, I'm curious about certainty in other ways besides regulatory. I'm curious about the technology itself, potential hacks, potential chains, depegging if it's a stable coin. I'm wondering about your thoughts on layer one protocols in general here and investor appetite for them after some of the mishaps we've seen.
Great question. And if you look at the space and the many cycles, let's not confuse cyclical issues with secular growth. In times like this, this is when actually the quality companies or quality protocols or quality applications that actually gain market share and have even more innovation and build better. So my opinion is it's unfortunate. No one likes to see crypto asset prices go down, but the benefit of it is the guys or the people with quality products that have better utility and are really building something real will take market share and also come out stronger and provide more utility in the end.
Also, when it comes to utility, you know, I know tomorrow in our crypto show, our weekly crypto show, 1:30 every week on Tuesdays, we're going to be talking about Ethereum, the merge, and gas fees, and whether they can come down in light of new projects. I mean, I'm wondering how this also pertains to you and Avalanche and the ability to bring down gas fees at the end of the day.
So first of all, great show. I already DVR that and I watch it all the time. So thank you for putting that on. And in terms of what the merge will be doing, it's really Ethereum will get to where Avalanche already is. The first part, it will come in stages, and the first part for them will be going into proof of stake, but it's still going to miss out on the instant settlement that Avalanche has or the scalability that Avalanche has. I mean, just this weekend, the Avalanche blockchain had a scaling function called a subnet, and these gaming companies actually launched on these subnets. Transactions on Avalanche increased 25%, while prices went down like 20-fold. There's more transactions now on Avalanche on a daily basis than are on Ethereum. So with the merge and with all these things that they're trying to improve, there will get to at some point a place where many newer generation layer ones are already at, such as Avalanche.
I should say the show also is at 1 p.m. My bad, John, but thank you so much. We also, speaking of Avalanche and the ability to kind of make it through this down market, I'm wondering from your perspective, as things are kind of cooling down in the crypto market, what do you take this time to do?
Take this time to focus. Again, the ones, it's similar to the segment previous when you had the venture capitalists on. The good companies that have a good, call it balance sheet, they have the ability now to gain share and to continue to build. Maybe instead of thinking about 18 months or 24 months for the next raise, you want to be a little more frugal and last for, you know, 24 to 30 months. But with that said, the ones with a good balance sheet and the ones with good products should go out there and innovate and take some share. So that's how Avalanche and Avalabs is treating this downturn.
Such a pleasure, both of you. John Wu, of course, president of Ava Labs, and our very own Bloomberg, Shanali Bosick, joining us for Crypto Show, as she does, as always. Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness topped the box office for the second straight week, underscoring the appeal of superhero films. But the theater business, it is still struggling to come back. Let's get into all of this with our very own Bloomberg's Lucas Shaw. Could this be seen as a bellwether for the way the industry is recovering?
Well, the performance of the new Doctor Strange movie is a really good sign for the movie business. It's outperforming its predecessor, the initial Doctor Strange, by quite a bit. It's already grossed more than it in just a couple of weeks. That being said, you know, the comic book movies are those that we know people are coming back to see comic book movies. The most recent Spider-Man movie is one of the most successful movies of all time. The real question is, are people going to come in between those comic book movies? And I'm not sure Doctor Strange helps us answer that.
Interesting. I'm also thinking big picture about what we learned from Netflix and the decline of maybe the quote stay at home, the streaming, the subscribers there. Is that a sign that maybe we're not watching it at home, but we are indeed thinking about going back and seeing theaters outside?
Yeah, I mean, people are definitely going out into the world. You know, I'm sure you guys have had folks on TV talking about, you know, hotel stays being pretty close to normal. Lots of, you know, travel is up. People are going out into the world to concerts, theme parks. I don't know that movies are everyone's first choice. You know, the movie business is on track to do better than it did in 2020 and 2021. That's, of course, not saying all that much. It's still right. Well below right now the numbers from 2019.
Yeah, I mean, that's not saying a lot, I think, as you appropriately put. Talk to me about Netflix specifically, a strategy to look at releasing movies in theaters, maybe take advantage of the reopening. They haven't really done that before. What is that telling you? How do you gauge the success?
Yeah, you know, Netflix has released movies in theaters, but not kind of globally in the major chains. They've had to pick off a lot of the smaller chains and the independent theaters. There is a desire in certain corners of Netflix to take at least a handful of their titles and give them what we think of as a normal release, where it'd be only in theaters for a month or 45 days. There'd be a real marketing campaign behind it so that people actually knew that it was coming out, because Netflix often saved its marketing for after a title is out. But the big question is whether the people at the very top of Netflix want to do this. You know, movie theaters, as we just discussed, want fresh product. They would love to get their hands on Netflix movies for all their talk about how Netflix is killing their business. But they're only going to take those movies if Netflix commits to marketing them, specifically those in theaters. And I'm hoping that we'll see some resolution on this in the next few months. I know that Netflix is talking about or exploring testing a couple of big titles in the fall, say the sequel to Knives Out, which was a huge hit a few years ago. But we don't know the resolution just yet.
really appreciate it. Our very own Lucas Shaw joining us as always. And well, that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. But don't worry, we're back tomorrow and we are going to be live from Boston, starting with the close, 2 p.m. Eastern. I'll be joining us. Then we'll take you through Triple Take and then finishing off with the triple threat. That is Bloomberg Technology. It'll be 2 to 6 p.m. live, of course, from Boston. So make sure to check it out. Also, don't forget to check out our new podcast. You can find it on the terminal as well as online on Apple, Spotify, and iHeart. This is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.